Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Can someone who committed a gruesome act of murder be rehabilitated? Is it possible that through their Christian faith they have found salvation? Carla Faye Tucker was deep into drugs when she murdered two people, claiming she was sexually gratified each time the pickaxe she used pierced their skin. Then she became a Christian, and suddenly people were calling for a reprieve of her execution. Was she a master manipulator, or had she indeed changed? You decide. Okay, on to the show. Carla Faye Tucker was born on November 18, 1959. In Houston, Texas, to Larry and Carolyn Tucker. She had two older sisters, Kathy Lynn and Carrie Ann. Carla would chime in that her mother chose all K-A's when introducing her sisters. Her father, Larry, was a longshoreman working on the Houston Ship Channel, while her mother, a college dropout, turned homemaker to raise the three girls. Carla recalls a fairly normal childhood, despite her parents separating from time to time. While her sisters remembered a relationship entirely different from what Carla remembered, they would recount years of a tumultuous love-hate relationship shared by their mother and father. Larry and Carolyn would officially divorce when Carla was 8 years old. He would claim that she was a whore by trade, which resulted in him gaining full custody of all three of the girls. Carla was also hit with the news that Larry Tucker was not her biological father. Carolyn, despite being a homemaker, liked to wander from her home on occasion. It was during these jaunts outside the home that Carla was conceived. Carla was 8 when she first picked up her smoking habit. In fact, she and her siblings began smoking quite regularly after their parents' divorce. Carla lived with Larry for 2 years after the divorce until he eventually allowed Carla to live with her mother. This was as a result of his work schedule. He was afraid, with all the time he was spending away from the home, that Carla would fall deeper into her wild ways. By the age of 10, she was already smoking marijuana, drinking, and shooting up heroin. Left to her own devices and under the influence of her older sisters, Carla began getting into regular fights at school, which eventually caused her to be expelled. Larry was in over his head with just Carla, and although the two girls had already moved in with Carolyn, he knew that Carolyn was still living a wild life, but he figured that she could control the girls better than he could. He was thinking, at this point, it couldn't get any worse. When her mother caught her smoking marijuana, she told her, "If you're going to be smoking dope, you better do it right." She brought rolling papers in from the other room and watched as Carla perfected her joint rolling. This isn't the behavior you would expect from a parent who is trying to steer their children in a good direction. Under her mother's care, Carla's wild side would flourish. She lost her virginity at age 12 to an unknown male at a house party and continued engaging in the drug scene. Her mother turned to prostitution to make ends meet. One of Carla's close friends, Debbie Bullard, called her mother a high-dollar whore. Carolyn was all about running a successful business, even if the business was selling her body. Carla dropped out of high school at age 14. School just wasn't for her. She was more interested in doing what her sisters were doing, which was having sex, doing drugs, drinking, and partying. This is also the age that Carolyn brought Carla along as a fellow groupie, following several popular bands as they toured across the United States. One of those bands was the Allman Brothers, whose most famous song was "Ramblin' Man." They left the tour and joined the Marshall Tucker Band, whose hit was "Heard It in a Love Song." And after they were done partying and having sex with some of those members, they hit the jackpot. They followed the Eagles. If you're wondering, why hasn't this girl gotten pregnant yet? It's because she had several health issues related to her reproductive organs. Doctors informed Carolyn that Carla needed a hysterectomy, And while it may seem like that's devastating news to receive, for Carla, she was actually happy about it. She didn't have to worry about getting pregnant, and she could continue living her lifestyle worry-free. Carla and her mother were very close during her teenage years. They shared drugs, and eventually, an occupation. Carla was 15 when she was first propositioned. She was hitchhiking, which was common during the 70s. The man who offered her a ride said he would pay her $20 if she exposed just one breast. Without hesitation, she pulled out her right breast. He handed her the $20, and he asked to see the other one. She pulled out her left breast. Sitting exposed in the front seat of a stranger's car, Carla was now $40 richer. When she arrived home later that evening, Carla told her mother what had happened. Carolyn had a thing about honesty. She always expected the truth from her children, and more often than not, she got it. Instead of chastising her daughter not to follow in her footsteps, Carolyn took $20 from Carla and said that if she was going to start, then she could at least help pay rent. At this time, Carla was living with her mother's friend Adele, and Adele's boyfriend Scott, who claimed to be a Green Beret. Scott was a mentor in a way to Carla, often teaching her martial arts and perfecting the speed bag. He also taught Carla how to perfect oral sex. She had seen her mother and Adele performing the sex act on him and wanted to learn more about deep throating. The three women were oddly proud of being able to do this. Maybe I need to remind you. Carla was just 15. Scott and two friends would coax Carla into the bedroom at times to perform oral sex on her. Her mother and Adele both exclaimed that she didn't know what she was missing. So, unbothered, she went into the room with the three men as they took turns on her. She couldn't climax. They tried multiple times to get her to climax, but nothing. Adele even tried, but was unsuccessful. Carla just didn't enjoy it. In 1979, Carla met Stephen Griffith, whom she would later marry. It was around this time that Carolyn was losing her third battle with hepatitis. Her body just couldn't take it anymore. This was primarily as a result of her intravenous drug use. Her mother would pass on December 24, 1979. Carla idolized her mother, and her death hit her hard. Years later, Carla would say that this was a turning point for her. Her mother's death is what caused her to turn stone cold. Still grieving her mother and unhappy in her marriage, Carla was overcome with anger. She was known as a hot-headed scrapper. She was proud that she could handle her own against a man. The next couple of years would be a blur to Carla. She would meet a woman named Sean who would quickly become a fellow roadie and roommate. It was through Sean that she met Danny Garrett, a man she was instantly attracted to. He was exactly what her husband wasn't, a strong, bad man who could hold his own in any situation. It was in the same year, 1981, that Sean would begin dating Jerry Lynn Dean. Carla hated him instantly. It's hard to narrow down what exactly led to her extreme hatred for Jerry. It could have been Sean and Jerry having sex in her bed one night, or it could have been Jerry parking his Harley in the middle of the living room floor while oil dripped on her carpet. Whatever the reason, Carla hated him. She would constantly throw him out of the house and even punch him in the face. One time, she punched him so hard in the face that his glasses cut his eye open. Sean and Jerry would eventually marry, and Sean moved out of the apartment she shared with Carla. Over the course of the next 2 years, Carla would divorce her husband and move in with Danny Garrett. Her relationship with Sean remained strained as a result of her marriage with Jerry. It was 1983, and Carla still hated Jerry just as much as the day she met him. She recalls one particular incident where Sean held on to her personal items, including precious photo albums, while she was in between homes. Sean returned them when she moved into a new house. But when Carla saw the state of her photo albums, seeing all the stab marks, She called Sean to inquire about what happened. Sean reluctantly shared that Jerry got mad at Carla for being a bad influence on her. Carla was livid. How dare he stab the most precious thing to her? Her mother's pictures were in there. She hung up the phone, and she let that anger boil inside of her until it was ready to spill over. Although she was now living with Danny Garrett after her bitter divorce from Steven, Danny wanted to marry her. Carla was hesitant. She was content just living with this man and partying with her new biker friends. Carla loved the idea of outlaw motorcycle gangs, and she was eager to join their ranks. They had no cares in the world, in her opinion. They drank when they wanted, did drugs when they wanted, were loyal to each other until the end, and were a family, even if it was dysfunctional. She was fine with dysfunctional. That is all she knew. Carla, Danny, and a friend Jimmy were binging on drugs the weekend of June 10th, 1983. It's hard to say what drugs she was using because she used all of them. She took pills, cocaine, heroin, and any other mixture she could get her hands on. She, of course, mixed them all with alcohol. It was on June 13th, 1983, where Carla's hatred for Jerry Dean would finally be released. There were a million reasons that Carla hated him. He had threatened Sean after their divorce, and even beat her up. Of course, there was the photo album stabbing and the oil dripping in her living room carpet, and the sex in her bed. She had plenty of reasons to hate Jerry Dean. It just depended on the day for her.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
After their drug binge was winding down, Danny and Jimmy were going crazy. They were antsy to get into some trouble. Danny was the first one to come up with the idea to head to Jerry Dean's apartment. He began to draw an outline of the apartment. Carla had coincidentally found the spare keys in Sean's jeans that she had washed for her. This was a stroke of good luck, just not for Jerry. Carla was in the middle of building her own bike to be able to ride alongside her brothers and sisters. Danny suggested that they go to Jerry Dean's to case the apartment to potentially rob it in the future. He knew that Jerry had just ordered some motorcycle parts, so these would actually help in the construction of Carla's bike. Danny wanted to be prepared for any outcome, so he brought some gloves and a shotgun. They had no intention of actually stealing anything that night, or even to see Jerry. So they say. They set out on their recon mission to case the complex. Having a shotgun didn't seem strange. It was Houston, and they weren't in the best part of town. They drove just 5 miles to get to his apartment. Jimmy and Danny got out of the car first to check out where the exits and entrances were for each side of the complex. They returned to the car to tell Carla to open the door. She takes a change in plans in stride and walks up to unlock the apartment door. Later she will say, "I don't think we decided on anything, but I don't know. But I think from the time we opened the door, after that, I think from then on, those people in there did not have a chance." They walk into the small apartment, and as they close the door behind them, a voice calls out, "What's going on?" Danny and Carla make their way to the bedroom that Jerry Dean is in. It was dark, but a small strip of light was shining in the room. When Carla walked in, she saw Jerry Dean sitting upright on his mattress that was on the floor. Carla went and sat on Jerry Dean's lap. Jerry Dean was smaller in stature, standing at 5'5 and 142 pounds, while Carla was at best 105 pounds and 5'1". Once Jerry realized that it was Carla who was sitting on top of him, he got scared. She had attacked him before, and he knew that she was probably here because of the threats against Sean. He tells her, "Carla, we can work it out." She coolly tells him, "Move, and you're dead, motherfucker." Jerry must have seen Danny standing behind Carla with a shotgun, and he pleaded for a peaceful resolution. He promised not to press charges, He must have realized at some point that he needed to try and make a run for it. He grabbed Carla's arms, and they wrestled a bit. Danny shoved Carla off Jerry's lap and onto the floor. He grabbed a hammer that was by Jerry's bed and began to hit him over the head. Carla ran to turn on the light to make sure that Danny was done hitting him. Danny, tired from the bludgeoning, left the room. Carla watched as Jerry, lying on his stomach, started making a gurgling noise. His head had been hit so hard that it was now unhinged from his neck. Carla couldn't stand the noise and picked up the pickaxe and stabbed it in his back a few more times. Meanwhile, Jimmy is told to come into the apartment to help Danny move the motorcycle parts into his truck. Jimmy heard the noises that Jerry was making and went back to investigate. When he saw what occurred, he said he was leaving because this wasn't part of the plan. He left Danny and Carla to do whatever it was they were planning on doing and hitched a ride home with a friend. Carla was still hammering the pickaxe into Jerry's back, trying to stop the gurgling. Danny came back in, rolled Jerry over, and made one more fatal stab into his chest. He finally was quiet. Danny went back to packing up the motorcycle parts in his truck, and Carla stayed behind in the room. Reasons are unclear. When all was quiet, Carla noticed that there was a body underneath a heap of covers by the bedroom door. She picked up the pickaxe that Danny had thrown on the ground and swung it down into the person who was trying to conceal themselves. The axe grazed the shoulder of 32-year-old Deborah Thornton. Carla was tired of swinging it by now. Deborah, or Debbie as she was called by her family, was a married woman and a mother of one who had met Jerry Dean at a cookout earlier in the day. She agreed to accompany him to his apartment to continue the party. Although she had no idea that a fun day of partying by the pool and casually sleeping with a man that she had just met would lead to her brutal death. Deborah, unlike Jerry, decided to fight back. She had a son to live for and was not going to be taken away from him so easily. She got up and grabbed the pickaxe from Carla's hand. At that moment, Danny rushed back into the bedroom and snatched it from her, standing in between the two women. Carla eventually left the room, and Danny began to brutally attack her over and over with the axe. When Carla returned, she saw Debbie sitting on the floor with the blade protruding from her shoulder. In agonizing pain, Deborah told them to hurry up and kill her because it hurt too much. She was still trying to remove the axe from her shoulder when Danny kicked her in the head and pulled the weapon from her. She landed flat on her back, and he slammed the axe into her chest. The blade would be buried 7 inches into her heart. They finished loading the parts into the back of Danny's truck. Carla drove off in Jerry Dean's El Camino, while Danny drove his truck back to their home. The bodies were found the next day by a friend, and it was all over the news that two people had been brutally murdered with a pickaxe. The two murderers had gone home to celebrate the loot they scored. Of course, in true Carla fashion, she was ready to brag about the murders. She shared a home with her sister Carrie, who coincidentally was in a relationship with Danny's brother Douglas. Carla and Danny bragged about the killings and boasted about how cold they were to them. They were totally unaffected. They bragged how hard it was to kill Deborah, saying, "That girl was a tough motherfucker to kill." Carrie and Douglas were fearful for the first time of what Carla and Danny were capable of. They even heard them talking about wanting to murder Jimmy. Now that they knew they could kill with ease, it would be easy. It would be Douglas and Carrie who would turn their siblings in. Douglas even agreed to wear a wire to record the conversations between the couple. It was during one of the sessions where Carla made her most grotesque confession to Douglas. She said, "Doug, I come with every stroke." And Doug responds with,
Did you?
Oh, hell yeah.
They were arrested on July 18, 1983 in their home. When Carla was questioned, she readily admitted that she hated Jerry Dean because of him hurting Sean, the oil on the floor, and most importantly, for damaging the few pictures she had left of her mother. Danny kept quiet. He knew how these things worked. He wasn't going to give the cops anything. They didn't have anything on him anyway. But what he didn't realize, and what Carla didn't realize, was that their siblings were the ones responsible for their arrests, and eventually, for their charges of first-degree murder. Carla's trial began on April 11, 1984. She entered a plea of not guilty. The prosecutor had all he needed in the audio tapes, where Carla speaks of being sexually gratified in a cold, dark, monotonous tone, and through the testimony of those who heard her brag of the murders. Her defense team only called one witness, Carla. Carla was sober, something she hadn't experienced since she was 7 years old. And while on the stand, she claimed that she did not feel the killings were real to her at the time, and that she did not see the bodies with any holes or blood. But that tape sealed her fate. And just after 70 minutes of deliberation, the jury came back with a guilty verdict of first-degree murder. She was sentenced to death by lethal injection. Danny would receive the same sentence. And although Jimmy was there for the murders, he did not participate nor face any charges. Instead, he testified on behalf of the prosecution. Carla was remanded to the Mountain View unit in Gatesville, Texas, which is 3 hours north of Houston. It was here that Carla would find God. She recalls being in her prison cell and reading the Bible. She doesn't remember much after that, except being on her knees in the middle of her cell, arms stretched above her, and crying, begging for forgiveness, begging for his love. It seems as if Carla was born again overnight. She became a model prisoner and even helped counsel other inmates where they were having difficulties. She was cordial with guards and was well respected among them. She was baptized in October of 1983, just 4 months after committing 2 gruesome murders. The news of her conversion would divide those who supported the death penalty. By all accounts, Carla had changed. She was sober, kind, and thoughtful, a stark difference from the hot-headed drug addict she was the last 15 years of her life. She joined AA and met Chaplain Rebecca Lewis, who would help guide Carla's faith. Chaplain Rebecca can typically tell when inmates are faking their Christianity. She's seen it time and time again, doing it just to get a lighter sentence. She never saw Carla waver in her faith, never saw the woman who so many said was wild and cruel. She only saw a passionate woman who was open to God. She even married a man of God. His name was Dana Brown, and in 1995, they were married in a Christian ceremony in the prison. The years would pass, and Carla's time in prison was mostly uneventful. She would spend 14 years on death row. Some capital punishment supporters changed their mind after seeing her transformation. Some still believe she was just manipulating the system, trying to get then-Governor George W. Bush to commute her execution. She wrote a letter to him that stated in part, "I am in no way attempting to minimize the brutality of my crime. It obviously was very, very horrible, and I do take full responsibility for what happened. I also know that justice and law demand my life for the 2 innocent lives I brutally murdered that night. If my execution is the only thing, the final act that can fulfill the demand for restitution and justice, then I accept that. I will pay the price for what I did, in any way our law demands it. I used to try and blame my mother because she was my role model and she fashioned and shaped me into what I was at an early age. At 14, she took me to a place where there were all men who wanted to school me in the art of being a call girl. I wanted to please my mother so much. I wanted her to be proud of me. So instead of saying no, I just tried to do what she asked. The thing is, deep down inside, I knew that what I was doing was wrong. It may have been the norm for the crowd I was in, but it was not the norm for decent, upstanding families. I no longer try to lay the blame on my mother or on society. I don't blame drugs either. When I say that I was out of it on drugs and I brutally murdered two people, I fully realize that I made the choice to do those drugs. Had I chosen not to do those drugs, there would be two people still alive today. But I did choose to do drugs, and I did lose it, and two people are dead because of me. I did not plan on going over there that particular night to go into that apartment to kill anyone, but that is beside the point. The fact is, we went there, we went into the apartment, we brutally murdered two precious people, and we left out of there, and even bragged about what we did for over a month afterward. It was in October, 3 months after I had been locked up, when a ministry came to the jail, and I went to the services. That night, I accepted Jesus into my heart. When I did this, the full and overwhelming weight and the reality of what I had done hit me. I began crying that night for the first time in many years, and to this day, tears are a part of my life. I am seeking you commute my sentence and allow me to pay society back by helping others. I can't bring back the lives I took, but I can, if I'm allowed, help save lives. That is the only restitution I can give. Unwavered by her words and by calls from then Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson, conservative commentator Tucker Carlson, and even Ronald Carson, Debbie Thornton's brother, to commute her sentence, Governor Bush denied the request to commute her execution. This meant that Carla would be the first woman to be executed in Texas since 1863. Carla was set to be executed on February 3, 1998. She requested that her sister Carrie, her husband Dana Brown, Jackie Onken, a friend, and Debbie Thornton's brother, Ronald Carlson, be in attendance. Those on the other side who came to watch Carla die were less convinced of her conversion. They were Debbie's husband Richard, her son William, and stepdaughter Katie. Prison officials were also there as standard procedure. These were Carla Faye's last words. "Yes, sir, I would like to say to all of you, the Thornton family and Jerry Dean's family, that I am so sorry. I hope God will give you peace with this. Baby, I love you. Ron, give Peggy a hug for me. Everybody has been so good to me. I love all of you very much. I am going to be face to face with Jesus now. Warden Baggett, thank all of you so much. You have been so good to me. I love all of you very much. I will see you all when you get there. I will wait for you." She was pronounced dead at 6:45 p.m., less than 10 minutes after receiving the lethal injection. Carla's execution still hits hard for those who staunchly believe in her conversion. Others remain unmoved by her supposed change. I'm interested in what you think. I think it's fair to say that many of the responses will be split. And I do believe that drugs change people and can cause them to do some pretty heinous things. I'm not sure what to think of her conversion. After researching the episode, I was left kind of being a devil's advocate, for lack of a better phrase. I can see both sides and understand the arguments. Like I said, I'm most interested in what you believe, so be sure to share your thoughts with me. Until next time. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. We're also on Instagram. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, you can send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. I would like to thank the most recent Patreon supporters: Haley, one half of Curiosity Kills, Megan D, Olivia F, True Crime All the Time, Janet G, Eileen and Colleen, hosts of Misconduct, a true crime podcast, Sarah G, Nina Instead, host of Already Gone, and finally, Michelle F. All of you have helped me reach my very first goal, and I am so thrilled, so thank you a million times over for your support. And thank you to Laura R. and Kate G. for your recent donations. You'll be receiving your gift and swag in the mail very soon. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Let me know what you think. And finally, I will be off getting married towards the end of March, which means that I won't have time to work on the next episode. Don't worry, I've decided to turn it over to my mom, who will be sharing a story that has touched our family. You won't want to miss it. Thank you again for your support, and I know we are only 11 episodes in, but I cannot wait to continue delivering more content to you.